For more than two decades, the nonfiction books and journalism award-winning author T.J. English has chronicled the American underworld. From his debut book, The Westies, and subsequent bestsellers Paddywhacked and Havana Nocturne, T.J. English's work has captivated readers worldwide. His latest book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, is an account of the Whitey Bulger fiasco, and once again it demonstrates the top-notch reporting and masterful storytelling that T.J. English has come to be known for. A former New York City taxi driver, he brings out this rare combination to bear on his work, a feel for the streets. It's also rigorous research and scholarship. The book is also intimate and personal, and it's a comprehensive and definitive look at the Irish mafia boss, Whitey Bulger. T.J. English, welcome to Words on a Wire.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. It looks like you've been busy out there. You're calling us from New York, is that right, New York City?
Calling you from downtown Manhattan.
Oh, nice.
Nice. All right, great.
You're not a taxi driver anymore, are you?
No, no. You know, the nice thing about having been a taxi driver is every day that I walk outside and see these wave of cabs coming up the avenue, I'm reminded how thankful I am that I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's how I feel like every time I go to a restaurant because I was a waiter for so long.
Yeah.
Well, we love your book. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Where the Bodies Were Buried. And maybe we could just start off with asking you a little bit about the subject of the book, Whitey Bulger.
Right. Can you tell us just a little bit about who he is?
Whitey Bulger was a notorious gangster in the city of Boston from about the mid-70s to the mid-90s. He controlled the criminal rackets in the city. He committed a lot of murders in the act of doing so. And he was unique in a number of ways. Number one, he had a brother who was probably the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts, William Bulger, Billy Bulger, who was a state senator and eventually president of the Massachusetts State Senate. And also, unbeknownst to just about everybody at the time, he was an informant for the FBI, what they call a top echelon informant, a high-ranking informant for the FBI. He was feeding them information primarily about his rivals in the mafia.
Right.
And in return, his FBI handlers were feeding him information about rivals within his organization that often resulted in murders and other criminal acts. So he created a situation where he was covered in a number of areas, and he became a very powerful figure there for a long period of time. And eventually, after his FBI handler retired and he was sort of out in the cold, he was indicted by another law enforcement agency, the DEA.
Right.
And he went on the run. He was tipped off that he was going to be indicted, and he went on the run in 1995. And he was at large somewhere in the world for the next 16 years.
Wow.
Before they finally caught him in Santa Monica, California,
right,
in the summer of 2011. And he was brought back to Boston, and he was put on trial, a major racketeering trial, a couple summers ago, 2013. So that's the summation of the Whitey Bulger biography.
And I should actually mention for our listeners that this book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, the one we're talking about today, is actually the third installment of what you call the Irish or the Irish Mob Trilogy.
Right.
And, you know, and this book particularly seems that its main concern is not necessarily Whitey Bulger's crimes, but really the corrupt system that helped sort of enable a man like him to rise to such unprecedented power, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. An important point. You know, I've written a number of books. This is the seventh book, and I've done a lot of journalism on different aspects of organized crime, different layers of the criminal underworld, and particularly how the criminal underworld, what we call the underworld, functions alongside the upper world, the so-called legitimate society of politics and business and so forth. And I've spent a career trying to get at the truth of this, get into the dark corners of this, how these two worlds function together. And have for a long time in the United States of America. So the Bulger story was kind of a classic illustration of this because so much of his power derived from corruption and his relationships and alliances within the upper world. So that's really what made the story so fascinating to me. I mean, he is an interesting character in and of himself.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And there has been a lot of fascination with him over the years, but I was more interested in the what I call the universe of corruption that helped to create Bulger.
You know, when I started to read this, I didn't know anything about Whitey Bulger, but after a while, I started to understand that a lot of the images from the popular culture that I have of Boston mobs and of the Irish mob comes from Whitey Bulger. It's based on Whitey Bulger. You got movies like The Departed, which is very loosely based on him. And then, of course, you have Black Mass, a recent movie with Johnny Depp, who plays Whitey Bulger. And there's documentaries on Netflix, and there's books, and so many books. Almost every one of his worst right-hand men wrote a book and capitalized, you know, quite profitably. Right. And so I'm wondering, you know, with all this stuff about Whitey Bulger, why were you compelled to write one more book?
Yeah, well, initially I didn't want to do it. My agent, when Bulger was captured in 2011, and it was a big media story, my agent came to me and said, you've got to do a book on this. I had done, you know, the previous two books, one called The Westies and another one called Paddywhack. Right. And Paddywhack was a big sweeping history of the Irish-American gangster from the time of the Irish potato famine all the way up to and including Whitey Bulger. And in fact, when Bulger was arrested in Santa Monica and they confiscated his belongings, the book Paddywhacked was on the shelf.
Awesome.
Right next to his bed. So he was a guy who was aware of his own history and his own shaping his own historical record. But anyway, yeah, there had been a lot of books, and I didn't really see where another one was needed. Although I was interested in sort of covering it as a journalist. So I was writing stories for the Daily Beast website leading up to the trial. And as the trial started to take shape, I began to realize that the trial was being shaped sort of as a cover-up, as an attempt, yes, to prosecute Whitey Bulger for his crimes, which was the easy part, by the way. There was just a ton of evidence against him by that point.
Right.
But the government needed to do this in such a way that they kept the trial from going in to the aspects of the government's complicity in Bulger's criminal reign, the way that he had a relationship as an informant. And not only that, that predecessors, the generation before Bulger had inherited a lot of these corrupt relationships. They'd been in existence in Boston going back half a century.
Wow.
So the government was using the trial as a way to further whitewash the set of arrangements that had created Bulger. And that's when I realized, hey, there's still a need for a book here, because that aspect of the story had been given short shrift over the years.
I know that the other aspect of the trial is that it seemed that Whitey, at least in terms of Whitey Bulger's perspective, that he was mostly concerned with proving that he wasn't a rat or an informant. Is that right?
Yeah, that was unusual and unexpected. People were gearing up for this trial, and there was a lot of speculation about whether this trial would be an occasion for the full truth of the Whitey Bulger story to finally be revealed. And there were rumors that Whitey was going to take the stand and testify and name names. And unfortunately, from the beginning of the trial, it was clear that wasn't going to happen, because Bulger was unwilling to admit that he had ever been an informant.
Right.
And, you know, there was an informant file of more than 700 pages. And so it was kind of absurd, really.
Right.
He had been an informant. That was clearly documented both within the criminal justice system and also by other criminals in his world. But, you know, in the criminal underworld, believe it or not, there are certain codes and rules of behavior. And probably the number one rule in the criminal underworld is that you don't rat.
Right.
You don't become an informant.
Right.
So I guess Bulger felt that he needed to preserve that fiction right up until the end.
He's referred to as a top echelon informant, which I, from what I understand, means that he's very important to the FBI to get information to the FBI about the mob, about other rival gangs. But there's also this truth that he really didn't provide much information, that he got the protection of a top echelon informant, but really he was just using the FBI and John Connolly in order to advance his position.
Yeah, very, very good point. There's so many layers to this story.
Yeah,
it goes
right.
down so many little tributaries and
sure.
side streets. And one of those side streets, of course, was that Bulger and his FBI handler, John Connolly, grew up in the same neighborhood,
right.
South Boston. They knew each other or knew of each other. Connolly was actually closer to Whitey's brother, the senator,
mm-hmm.
Billy Bulger,
right.
had worked on his political campaigns and whatnot. And the idea was that these guys entered into this pact as some sort of a mutual beneficial arrangement that Connolly would protect Bulger and Bulger would feed Connolly information that would help enhance his career. And what that required was that Connolly puff up Whitey Bulger's status within the system as an informant to make him look more valuable than he was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I
and
see.
So
right.
John Connolly was actually stealing intelligence, stealing information from other informants' files and putting it in Whitey Bulger's file to try to make him look more valuable
wow.
as an informant than he really was.
The stories in this are so complex and rich. I mean, not just, and it's on both sides, you know, in terms of the sort of the governmental aspect of things and also, you know, the Irish mafia aspect. You know, there are like different characters and it's just a really complex story, you know, and I think that,
yeah.
And you know, you do a wonderful job in your book Where the Bodies Were Buried in sort of fleshing some of that out and making it, you know, accessible to the reader. One of the things that strikes me, though, as I was reading the book and even in talking with you here, you know, is that a book like this is really exposing a lot of the deep corruptions of governmental entities, the FBI, local law enforcement. And I would imagine that there's been at least some backlash to this. Have you experienced any backlash at all?
Not yet. I think it's going to take a while for that that type of backlash to formulate itself. And the response could come from any number of directions. You know, I'm particularly appreciate the opportunity to be talking to you guys about this because you're in El Paso, Texas.
Right.
And in El Paso, you get information on a daily basis in your newspapers and through the media about the narco war in Mexico.
Right.
And one of the similarities here, I think, really, when you're writing about criminal underworlds or criminal systems that operate in the underworld that involve that are very complex.
Sure.
I mean, anyone who sits down and tries to understand the narco war in Mexico, your brain is going to explode because it's so multi-layered
yeah.
and complicated, and it's connected to so many different aspects of the social world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these, of course, is how law enforcement is involved with and corrupted by these criminal systems.
Right.
And one of the key points at which this happens is the use of informants.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement people using people in the criminal underworld to gather information to make criminal cases that are going to enhance their careers and their stature within their world, the world that they work in. And so these complex systems and arrangements are so deeply embedded in this kind of organized criminal activity. And to get at them, There's certain dangers involved. I mean, one of the issues that I'm very concerned about is that in the narco world, for instance, is the
mm-hmm.
pressure on journalists and writers
right.
who are attempting to write about that world.
Right.
Many who've been killed,
mm-hmm.
many some
yeah.
who've been forced to cross the border and seek political asylum in the United States.
That's right.
The dangers in trying to tell the truth of these corrupt systems and the entity within the system often feels the most threatened by this are not necessarily the criminals. It's the so-called legitimate world. It's
right,
the government
right.
side of things. And so that's part of the context for the Whitey Bulger story that I think is relevant and has a kind of interesting correlation to what's happening in Mexico and all different sorts of organized crime stories.
You can't help but think of Midnight in Mexico by Alfredo Corchado.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Right. And how brave yeah. it is for him to write that book. And
right.
lives in Mexico City part of the year. And I'm thinking, man, that guy's just amazing what he's willing to sacrifice for the truth. And I thought of it also when you were saying that the top echelon informant system doesn't exist in name, but that it still exists in practice. And you gave as an example, perhaps the U.S. government's easing the way for one of the cartels here in Mexico, which really kind of brings the violence right home to us right here.
Yes, Yes. Well, again, yeah, it has to do with the use of informants and the shady sort of dark area in which those relationships exist and how they are often open to corruption, and they often wind up perhaps with the criminal playing the system, gaming the system to an extent, the system being used. And then when there's any possibility that that will be exposed, the system kicks into cover-up mode, seeks to cover up its own culpability in these actions. It's a story that replays over and over again. And if people aren't going to be honest about it and aren't willing to be honest about it, and if they are to sit back and allow the cover-up of this to take place, if we're to sit back and allow the Whitey Bulger story to be simply the story of this sort of crazy, charismatic sociopath who had this wild criminal career, if we're going to let it rest there without looking at the larger framework of responsibility on the part of the government, then it will happen again. And it is happening.
It is happening. That's right, yeah. We're speaking with the investigative journalist and nonfiction author T.J. English about his recent book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him.
Let's talk about the trial itself, which is really what the focus of the book is, and all the characters, including the family of some of the victims, like Donahue, who was very vocal, very theatrical, and who really provided a narrative for the case for those who didn't know much about it. Just, you know, the narratives of the victims kind of made it more interesting and more to the point. What really fascinates me is this serendipitous, I guess you could call it, fact that the trial was taking place during the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, that they happened so close together. And I'm wondering if that fact kind of fed you metaphorically, or were you able to make some sort of connection between that and the crime world of Whitey Bulger's?
Right. Well, it was interesting. It certainly made security measures at the courthouse a lot more complicated, because that trial, the trial of the Boston Marathon bomber, was sort of in its early stages of development while the Bulger trial was taking place within that same courthouse. So it sort of cast a dark cloud over everything, and it put things in an unusual perspective. You know, there were a lot of comparisons made that Bulger had terrorized. There had been some kind of terrorist in the city of Boston all those years when he was in power. But to me, I kept seeing the differences, which were that the Bulger story was deeply rooted in the politics of Boston and the whole region of New England, you know, both literally in the politics of it through Bulger's brother, but also Bulger's connections to the system, to the upper world. The fact that Bulger had been not only sort of tolerated and allowed to exist for such a long period of time, but that aspects of the system had covered for him, had protected him. Over those 20 years Bulger was in power, if there were ever possibilities that he was going to be pursued by some agency outside of the FBI, they would sabotage those investigations. They were deliberately protecting Bulger and keeping him out there on the street. And in fact, when Bulger went on the run and became the number one most wanted man on the most wanted list, there was a lot of belief that many within the system really didn't want him to be caught. In those initial years when he was on the run, that they weren't really trying very hard to find him. And, of course, the truth of that is that the unit that the FBI assigned to pursue and apprehend Bulger was the same organized crime unit that he had corrupted when he was an informant out on the street. So, yeah, that raises questions whether they ever really wanted to find him or not. But, you know, time passed and agents retired and other agents came in, and eventually they changed their focus from Whitey to his girlfriend that he was on the run with. She was known to have sort of a beauty routine, and so they started to disseminate information in beauty parlors, ads in magazines. And through beauty parlors, and it worked. A woman who had seen her in a beauty parlor in Santa Monica was the one who tipped off the FBI about where they were hiding out.
Wow.
you were there the entire time for the trial. You were inside the proceedings. You, I suppose, slept in a hotel and ate all your meals. And just what was a typical day like? You even had dinner with Martorano, which must have been really intimidating because he was known to have killed about 20 people.
I know.
Yeah, it's interesting. You read the book, you know. In some ways, I was a little closer to this story than normally you would want to be as a writer. I had been following it for a long time, and I'd gotten to know a number of Bolger's key underlings and associates who had, when Bolger went on the run in 95, you know, those who got left behind got indicted and made deals with the government and became witnesses at various trials and wrote books about their careers. And I had gotten to know some of these people, and in the criminal underworld, it's very treacherous to get to know sources too closely because you become compromised, perhaps, other sources who know you're close to that source don't like the fact that you're close to that source. You suddenly find yourself functioning within that world in a degree that's more comfortable than you might want it to be.
Right.
And that was kind of the case with the Bolger story. It was another reason I wasn't too enthusiastic about doing the book initially. Yeah, I lived up there. I lived in the North End, which is the Italian section of Boston, and it's a great neighborhood. It's really sort of an old world Sicilian neighborhood, and there's a lot of great food there. I think I put on about 8 pounds in 2 months from eating all that pasta. In fact, I lived in a little studio apartment right over a Sicilian bakery.
Oh,
and I would
dangerous.
Wake up every morning. Yeah, I would wake up every morning smelling that Sicilian olive bread, which I would buy first thing in the morning.
God.
It was wonderful. You know, the olive bread with the green, salty. So I'd wake up, I'd buy my olive bread, and I'd have a beautiful walk along the harbor in Boston to the courthouse every morning.
Wow.
And I'd go into this courtroom and hear these horrible stories of murder and mayhem. It was a pretty interesting experience. And it really was the trial itself with all these old-time gangsters being called to testify. You know, they're now in their 70s and 80s, and they're testifying about events that took place back in the 70s when they were, you know, young, robust men. It mm-hmm. created a weird kind of disconnect because you'd see this little 80-year-old man testifying about these horrible crimes and these things that he did. And sometimes it was hard to reconcile. I mean, Bolger himself was 82 years old by the time they got him, you know, into the courtroom to face the music. And, you know, he looked like what he was, a little old man.
wow.
He was not the fearsome Whitey Bolger of his prime. But it just reminds you of how history never really goes away. The consequences of history are not in the past, you know. That history is something that exists in the present.
One of the things that I found most interesting about your book here, TJ, is that, you know, you include yourself in this narrative. One of the moments that really kind of stand out to me was when I think it's a conversation you're having with maybe Kevin Weeks, and who was one of Whitey Bulger's sort of right-hand men. And I think he says to you, you know, Whitey should keep his mouth shut. And then you say, you know, I want to see him on the stand. You know, I want him to like name names. And he says, of course, he replies, of course you do. You're a writer. You know, you want the good story. And the conversations what Daniel mentioned a little bit ago, how you had, you know, you would dine with all these folks and sit down to meals with them. And you've put yourself in these really sort of precarious situations. And, you know, I'm just curious to know on a more personal level, what do you feel compels you to invest yourself in these stories, like with this one particular, but, you know, also there in Juarez and the narco trafficking? I mean, what makes you so willing to go to such depths to get a story?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. Because I did put myself in the narrative, and there are sections of this book that are written in the first person.
Right.
And I'd never done that before, and I wasn't really comfortable doing it. And the reason I did it with this book was that, as I was saying before, I had a pre-existing relationship with a number of these sources, and I felt I needed to be honest about that.
Sure.
That needed to be upfront, and so the reader can determine for themselves my relationship with these sources and how they should take that. You know, so much journalism is written, and you're not allowed to know that. You don't really know the sources that the writer has used, and you don't know the writer's relationship to those sources. So I felt I needed to be transparent about that, and,
sure.
and that involved putting the narrative in the first person at times. In terms of the larger aspect of your question of just undertaking these kinds of stories, I do think that what is ultimately driving me to do it is the desire to understand the way social systems function and operate, and the consequences for that for citizens, both on the criminal side of the law and also victims.
Sure.
Victims, those who are victimized by these arrangements, and also the corrosive effect that these kind of relationships have on what we call the upper world, the legitimate system.
Right. Right.
This is all endlessly fascinating to me, and I write about it from a historical context. I write about it sometimes from a contemporary context.
Right.
It really is, to me, it's getting at something that's really essential about how the United States of America functions. And so if you're drawn to this subject matter, you find yourself in precarious situations.
Right.
Oftentimes, a lot of the research I've done takes me to places like Tenement Yards in Kingston, Jamaica, or in colonias in Ciudad Juarez,
right.
or other places like that that are well outside of my normal daily experience.
Say that.
And you develop, or you have to develop skills for entering into these worlds and getting the information. And the primary skill to me is that you have to be able to spend time with criminals and in a criminal world, and you have to be able to do that without judgment, without passing judgment, without imposing your own worldview onto that situation.
Right.
Because if you do that, those people will recognize it and smell it a mile away.
Yeah,
you won't get any cooperation from that.
Right.
You mentioned that in your book. You call it the creed of professional curiosity.
Right.
Wonderful.
Yes.
The book is Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him. The author is T.J. English, who we've had the pleasure of speaking with. It's a fascinating book, T.J., and we're really lucky to have you here on the show, so thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Great. I enjoyed it.